listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
He's CNN's chief medical correspondent, a neurosurgeon, too. And at the beginning of the Obama administration, Sanjay Gupta met with the president about taking on the surgeon general position. He turned it down. He found it odd, he told me in my latest one-to-one podcast, that as surgeon general, he could no longer practice surgery. Of late, he's become a strong advocate for medical marijuana. Where he once denounced efforts to legalize the drug, he's now evangelizing marijuana as a potential treatment for all sorts of ailments. Talking about medical marijuana, reporting on health crises around the globe, and a new campaign to just say hello, CNN's Sanjay Gupta is my latest one-to-one podcast with a Q&A in the summer issue of Stanford Medicine, a special report on surgery. Sanjay Gupta, thank you for joining me at One-to-One. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with a question of marijuana. And in 2009, you wrote a piece for Time magazine opposing efforts to legalize marijuana. And now you've changed your position in a significant way. And as you've called it, you've doubled down on supporting the medical use of marijuana. Why the change? What happened during that intervening time?
Well, you know, I think there were a couple of things. One is that what I do typically as a reporter is I'm constantly been doing surveillance on the medical literature on various topics, and everything from heart disease, diabetes, neurodegenerative disorders, but also things like medical marijuana, potential new treatments for all sorts of things. And when I looked at the literature, you know, regularly for several years, it just wasn't that impressive, the literature coming out of the United States. I think there were a couple things that happened. One is that I started to become more aware of literature from smaller labs, labs that were outside the United States, and things that were happening over the intervening few years between 2009 and 2012, 2013. But also I realized that so many of the studies that were being done in the United States, the hypothesis, if you will, the premise of the study itself, the majority of them were designed to find harm. There's a institute called the National Institute of Drug Abuse that really had a major say in whether these studies would get funded. And as a result, I think, and they don't disagree with this, at NIDA, there were many studies designed to find harm. So if you looked at that from the macro level, it wasn't very impressive. It's when I started to get a broader context I started to dig deeper and reach some of these conclusions.
Do you worry at all about there's still some concern among neurologists, psychiatrists that raise concern about there does not seem to be in their mind good evidence that marijuana use, or they feel that marijuana use can increase the risk of serious psychiatric disorders and long-term cognitive issues. Do you worry about that?
Yeah, I mean, I do, and I think there's a couple of things. One is that I think that there is literature that is pretty compelling with regard to specific diseases such as epilepsy, mm-hmm. that is refractory, neuropathic pain, a very specific type of pain, and some of the things like muscle spasms brought on by MS. That's in addition to, I think, the things that most physicians think marijuana may have a use for, curbing the side effects from chemotherapy, stimulating appetite, things like that. So I think there's good evidence for some things, but I do think that when we were approaching this topic, one of the things that everyone seemed to agree on to some extent was that in order to get the answers to some of these questions and obtain the more satisfactory evidence in the United States, you had to make it easier to study. Right now you have a situation where it's scheduled as a Schedule I drug, which means that it is in the same category as the most dangerous substances in the world and is also, ordained to have no medicinal benefit. It's very hard to do double-blinded, randomized prospective trials on something that is already preordained to have no medicinal benefit. So I think in part this was a look, there is something here that is worth exploring. There is something here that has been explored in other countries. There is something here that people use in big hospitals and in places like Jerusalem. we don't have as much of an option to take a look at it in this country, and I think we should.
And is that because of, as you, if you've written about, the draconian system where politics overrides science and patients are caught in the middle?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at why things are scheduled as a Schedule One substance, again, deemed to be the most dangerous, in the category of most dangerous substances, it's usually because there is science showing that to be the case. Extremely high rates of addiction, extremely, you know, significant side effects. And again, no one is suggesting, I don't think anybody is suggesting, that there aren't any potential downsides to this as a medication, as there are with narcotics or a lot of the epilepsy medications that people are taking right now. But I think what you have in this case, it was scheduled as a one because there wasn't evidence showing that it wasn't dangerous. And that was in the letters back in the early 70s written about the justification for the scheduling. And it was very strange and very different than a lot of the way that a lot of other substances were treated.
As a CNN medical chief medical correspondent, you obviously, as you know, you have a lot of influence and power to influence healthcare and biomedical issues. How do you decide where and when and how you want to use that authority?
You know. I think for the most part, I recognize that there's a real public service component to what we do. I mean, you know, we're journalists at CNN in this regard. You know, I'm a doctor first, but with regard to the reporter job, you know, we're reporting on things that we think are of importance. But I do think with medical reporting, there is a public service component as well. So a lot of things where we think it can have a huge impact on people's lives. Maybe a small impact on a lot of people's lives, or a huge impact on a smaller number of people's lives. But whatever it may be, but I do think that there are issues where, you know, politics and propaganda do trump science, and I think in that regard, it's important to just make sure the science part of that is as well known as the other parts of it, the politics, the propaganda, which is where a lot of people focus their attention. The science of it oftentimes is not as interesting. It's not as easy to encapsulate in a headline. Whatever the reason may be, people don't often get that science. And I think, you know, with an issue like this, that was really our biggest driver. Let's just make sure people understand the science that exists, what we do know, what the limitations are, and then have a better idea of the issue as a whole.
Why neurosurgery? Why did you decide to go into that as especially?
I made that decision later than I think a lot of people who go into neurosurgery. As a lot of my colleagues who are brain surgeons, sort of, at least their story is that they wanted to be a brain surgeon since they were a kid. That wasn't the case for me. I thought I was going to go into pediatrics when I started medical school. I loved kids, and I loved, you know, spending my time on the pediatrics rotations when I was in medical school. I did a rotation in neurosurgery like a lot of other students do at one time or another, and it was one of those things where I immediately fell in love with it. There's something about surgery in general, which I think can be very satisfying, in that you can you have a specific issue or problem. Someone has a problem in their brain or their spinal cord, and you are going to address it that day in some way. And I think it feels very concrete to me. It's a way of thinking, I think. But I found that sort of ability to take care of patients more immediately to be very important to me and very gratifying.
What do you think are the ingredients that go into making a great surgeon? And has that changed?
I think one of the misperceptions, if I can start with that, is that these people are physical geniuses. I mean, there are certainly people who are talented with their hands, but I do believe, and now I'm somebody who trains neurosurgeons, that there's a small percentage of people who really can't do it for whatever reason. The coordination and the dexterity just isn't there. But I think the vast majority of people can be trained. It's 7 years of training, and so you really do learn a lot in terms of just the movements and the sort of the machinations of an operating room and how it all works together. I think surgeons, you know, it's a lot of hard work. I mean, you know, that was some of the most formative years of my life. I was working 100 hours a week in a hospital, so you know, it is a sacrifice in that regard. It's fewer hours now because of some of the legislation that Congress enacted, but still, it's a big commitment. But I also think you have to be somebody who works well under pressure, but is also not afraid to ask for help. I think that is the key. That there is a perception again of bravado among surgeons, and what you find is that with a lot of surgical specialties, the very best surgeons, sort of their judgment is impeccable. They know not only whether to operate, but what operation to do, but also if they're in a situation that is challenging or you know, they don't feel like they have complete control, they can call for help, and I think that becomes a really important thing.
Do you think the id of a surgeon has changed over the years?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that there is a there's sort of two answers. That one is the id of the actual surgeon change, or is the perception changed? Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe both of those things have changed to a certain degree. I guess the instinctual part, if that's how we're looking at id overall, that part of the brain that mm-hmm. is that thing that is so ingrained and there since birth, I think is probably the same. I think that there's a deep desire to want to help people and to do it immediately, to be able to train yourself in a specialty that's so specialized that you know you're among a a smaller group of people in the world who can do it. And I think that part of it is probably has been there and is still there. But I think the healthcare systems overall have changed, and I think the surgeon's role in the system has changed, and that may influence the perception of ego, superego, id, all of that.
You mentioned training, and you obviously work at a university hospital, Emory. Can you talk about the unique role of academic medicine?
Academic centers have lots of obligations that people don't always realize. I mean, one is that they train future doctors. Obviously, most of them have medical schools. Most of them have training programs. So after medical school, you go through training, and that's a unique function of academic centers. But it's not the only role. They also, I think, as a result of the place that they have in our society, end up taking care of many of the sickest patients. Oftentimes, the idea that they're called tertiary care centers, third line care centers, or quaternary care centers, fourth line, the patients that have not been able to be cared for in the community, or where doctors think more care is needed, a lot of times what they're talking about is an academic medical center. And then the third thing is, you also want to be innovative. You want to be doing research. You want to be sort of thinking about what tomorrow holds, and whatever. Particular area of medicine, clinical or basic science related, is going to be next, and I think that involves three roles, and there's a lot of people within academic centers who inhabit a portion of all three of those roles.
Have you thought at all about how surgical training could be improved? Do you, since the time that you were in med school and the time that has passed, have you given that any thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the one of the things that I think the work hour limitation a few years ago sort mm-hmm. of gave us some insights into, they said, look, we can't have doctors working more than 80 hours a week, 36 hours in a row. There's specific, hour requirements. And I think besides the specifics of that, it opened a little bit of a window into your question of, how are we doing overall in terms of training surgeons, and can we look at what seems to reap the most benefit in terms of how we train? Is it repetitive, things over and over again, doing the same activity over and over again, or is it, exposing the doctors to some component of the innovation, the understanding of why we do certain things, why certain instruments or devices or whatever, things may be used, just so to give them a better sort of insight into why medicine is practiced the way it is. And, as you might expect, I think it's a component of both. But I think the sort of kill and drill, if you'll take an analogy from, grade school mm-hmm. education, just repeating the same concept over and over and over again, there's certainly a role for that in surgery, but there has to be a lot more in terms of how we train people, understanding the healthcare system in which they operate, understanding the fact that at our core, you know, you're still a caregiver, and the compassion that comes with that is not something that can necessarily be taught, but has to be continuously reinforced by the mentors, you know, of those surgical trainees. You know, in my office, when patients come to the office, fewer than half of them really need an operation. They're coming to be evaluated, but what they're really coming for is knowledge, and sometimes it's the most important knowledge that they are going to hear for a long time. You know, directly affects their lives. So, you know, really making sure that's a part of the way that we train people to being able to dispense that knowledge in a careful, compassionate way.
You launched a new campaign to just say hello as a result of your investigation, I think, about the human impact of loneliness. And in a column you wrote that some of the stories that you've heard about loneliness stopped you dead. What did you hear? Why this campaign?
The campaign in some ways emanated from a lot of the conversations I had with people, professionals in the field of psychiatry and psychology after the shootings, the multiple mass shootings over the last couple of years. And as a reporter, as a medical reporter, I find myself reporting on a lot of these things, and you know, people always ask the questions of why this happened, and there's never a satisfactory answer to that. But I spent a lot of time with these specialists just sort of trying to understand what they thought of when they heard of these shootings, and this idea that, you know, oftentimes someone is described as a loner or as lonely or, you know, isolated, you know, whatever the adjective may be, that seemed to be something that came up, you know, many, many times when talking about these shootings. And I started to look at this component of our society and how we have maybe become more lonely as a society despite all the things that would suggest otherwise, with social media and seemingly more interconnected than ever before. And that's not a novel concept. But I think the consequences of feeling lonely, feeling that you live on the fringe, that's what really fascinated me. And when I started to talk to scientists who study this idea of loneliness as an evolutionary principle, people who were lonely, during the earlier times of evolution, they were often relegated to the fringe of a group. They didn't have as much access to the resources, to food and water. And as a result, they sometimes it would develop a real friction with the other group. You would perceive things that would be innocuous as a more harmful threat. And so there were all these components that were, I thought, quite stunning, but there was a lot of evidence to suggest that they were true. And then I thought, well, what can we do? You know, what does that mean? And just say hello obviously is not an answer to that problem by any means, but it could be a beginning to an answer. And the idea that anybody who says, look, I want to help. I know somebody at my workplace or my apartment building who is that guy or that gal who is lonely, clearly, and you know, reaching out in some way could help set that their lives and some of what's happening with them in a different trajectory. I sort of described it from a medical sense. When if someone were to drop of a cardiac arrest in front of you, you generally know what to do. You may know to call 911, to start pumping on their chest, try and provide blood flow through the body. What do you do if you see someone who's really suffering psychologically? What do you do? And that was what I really wanted to get this article.
Mm-hmm. As you travel around the country and around the globe, are there universal questions you're asked about medicine and healthcare or the human condition?
I travel all over, and healthcare is one of these things that it's very hard to describe in any kind of universal sense. Spent a lot of time in Haiti, for example, was there recently, and you talk about some of the issues there with regard to water, simply, you know, being able to understand what the water infrastructure was before the earthquake and after the earthquake and the context of communicable diseases and all sorts of different things. I think that the universal thing, when you don't think as much about the challenges, which, you know, you can't ignore, but when you start to look beyond that a little bit, the idea that it is something, I think, that ties us more together in terms of our quest for good health. I mean, when I start talking about things that can provide good health that are not in the form of a billion-dollar pill or a technological breakthrough or something like that, it's amazing how everyone wants to listen. Everybody, I think, fundamentally, I should say most people, most everyone wants to do good by their bodies, understand health, understand how they could improve the health of their family members, their kids, their families, whatever it may be. So I think that desire for good health and the desire for improved function is a pretty universal thing.
When you parachute into disasters around the globe, such as Haiti, besides the obvious tragedy that's unfolding, what do you look for to tell a compelling story?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it is if you take a situation like Haiti or Japan after the tsunami or earthquake in Pakistan, you know, I've covered a lot of these types of stories. Obviously, every war over the last 12 years now, it is a first. There's a lot of it is telling what is happening there, and I think you know, just a lot of times getting out of the way, frankly, of the camera, and maybe just pointing out things, you know, for people to see and drawing their attention to it, but not over reporting. You know, it's more that you're taking people to this place that they haven't seen, and I think you don't want to interfere with that too much, their ability to actually feel like they're there in some ways. But then provide the context so they understand better what they're seeing, as opposed to narrating the entire thing. But I think more broadly speaking, and after the first, you know, few hours, a few days, or whatever the time frame may be of that, I think that there is a desire for me, and I think part of it's being a medical reporter, to reinforce this point that what is happening here is not so different than what could happen where you are, that the people here are not so different from, you know, the people in your neighborhood. And I think health, more than anything else, serves as a common denominator for that. I mean, people want, again, that good health, and they also understand when people have been injured, they don't have access to health. They may not be able to identify Damascus on a map, but if I explain to them that when, you know, the bombs came raining down, the same family that had been driving their kids to school the day before, grocery shopping after that, stopping at a bank to withdraw some money from the bank, from an ATM machine, they are now fleeing with whatever few possessions they could gather and running for the border. That's a family like a lot of families in your own neighborhood. And I think it makes it more relevant. I don't know how people feel when they hear that. They feel more connected, if they feel more compassionate, if they feel more compelled in some way. I don't know, you know, what that does to people, but I think that's really important to me as a reporter.
Why was it important for you to become a storyteller, to become a journalist? Besides,
I think I was a storyteller since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, that's at least what my parents will say and my friends. I always like to tell stories. I think you know, I wasn't the best student when I was younger, and one of the tricks I think I learned for myself as a student, and that carried me through medical school and everything, was to really understand the stories behind things. So, you know, even when I was, you know, in medical school studying, you know, biological chemistry, understand the stories behind the people who had made interesting discoveries and why they made those discoveries made it stick in my brain, I think, a lot better, made me more likely to remember things. And I just like stories. I've always enjoyed telling them and hearing them, and as a voracious reader, remain, you know, somebody who likes to read about all sorts of different topics. And I think that you know, when I started writing, that was something I felt was a strength, and I just ran to it.
It's well known that you had talks with President Obama about being Surgeon General. As you look down the road, and you didn't accept it, obviously, as you look down the road, do you see yourself taking a position in public service? Is that something that you think, a path where you will take at some point?
I think it very well could be. You know, I've worked at the White House before. I worked for the Clinton administration in the late 90s, and you know, my interest at that time was in public service, and I think, you know, for me, the Surgeon General job, the timing wasn't the right thing for me. I would have had to give it up, give up my job as a neurosurgeon, which I found quite ironic that I couldn't practice surgery anymore as surgeon general. But I think it just wasn't the right time. But I could, you know, I've done it before, and I could absolutely see myself doing it again.
Great. Sanjay Gupta, thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you, okay. Paul. Appreciate it.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.